Welcome to Goshen Books. Hi, I'm Leanne Grunberg Wakabayashi here in Jerusalem, and I'm thrilled today to introduce my good friend, Edward Levinson, who for some 40 years has lived a life close to the land in Japan as a master gardener, an award-winning videographer, a worldwide exhibited photographer, and foreign homeowner of a hilltop sanctuary called Solo Hill that he and his wife Shizuka reinvented on a plot of terraced rice paddy. We're thrilled today to have Ed read from his memoir, Whisper of the Land. He'll be reading from his book and telling us about how his heartfelt and haiku-infused essays came to be. Ed, thank you for joining us.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you, Leanne, for inviting me, and thank you, everyone, for showing up. And before I do my first reading, I just wanted to introduce it a little bit that when I first came to Japan, 1979, well, I did a two-month impromptu homestay in the mountains of Kyoto with an organic farmer and eating natural food. And it was my first chance to learn about Japanese customs and Japanese culture, even though it was a mixed couple. It was a British man and his Japanese wife. After that, I ended up living almost eight years in Tokyo and in the suburbs, but I was lucky enough that I worked for 3 years as a Japanese gardener, so that even though I was living in the city, every day I was out in nature, up on ladders and cleaning, sweeping the gardens and doing lots of different things. So it was very interesting. And eventually I started to do some English teaching, but I didn't want to teach English. I wanted to depend on English for my income. So as many friends did, so I didn't teach English. But when I finally decided I needed to do something besides gardening, I started teaching some English, and I discovered that I was a good teacher, although not necessarily a good teacher of English. So I say all this because I truly believe that I found my first home, and that's part of the theme of this series of memoir writers, is finding your home away from home, so to speak. And that I really believe that I found my true home moving here to where I live now in the countryside of Chiba Prefecture on the Boso Peninsula. As Karen said, I also live on top of a hill, although we're pretty safe. There's nothing higher than us, so we won't catch any of the fallout from her. So to begin, I would like to start with the first it's the first chapter of the book. The book does have a foreword, and there's a prologue that sort of, you know, sets the stage for it. And then we just jump right in to something completely different. It's not a chronological book, to the disappointment, I would say, of some people. It's too hard to follow, it jumps around too much. And even the editors of the book said, are you sure you don't want to make this, you know, more chronological? I said, no, I want it to the way it is. And so that responsibility stays with me, not with the publishers. So we decided, this was on the Japanese version of the book as well, which came out first. We started off the book with a chapter called Morning Meditation, which is just sort of a self-introduction to myself. So I'll read it to you. I've printed it out on paper so that I didn't have to put on my glasses and try to read the small print in the book. Each chapter in this book starts with a haiku. Morning Meditation. Ginkgo leaf floats to the ground, homecoming. I fell in love easily. There it was, an old grand Japanese farmhouse, half hidden, yet half open to the surrounding country landscape. The first time I saw it, I knew I wanted it. It was flirting with my soul. This was exactly what I had been looking for, a new home in the countryside. In my mind, I had seen the image several times. Now, here it was for real. Friends were living there, fixing it up, and it started a garden as well. I was smitten and jealous. If you ever move out, I want this house, I told them emphatically, as I helped pull weeds and rake the cut grass. It was the end of 1987, and I was ready for a change. A few months later, my friends suddenly moved back to the States, and the house was mine to rent. In the spring, 1988, it was a relief to get out of Tokyo and back to nature, a positive step forward for my being. Moving to the Bosho Peninsula, 2 hours southeast of Tokyo, somehow felt like coming home. As I worked and remodeled the interior, enlarged the vegetable garden, I immersed myself in nature. The romance intensified. The farmhouse had natural air conditioning. In summer, we caught the night breeze, sleeping with all the windows open. The raucous voices of the country crows would wake me at dawn before the hot sun rose. "We'll have eaten all your tomatoes if you don't get up soon," they seemed to screech, obviously enjoying their breakfast party. It was only 4:30 a.m., but I would run out half naked and chase them away. This was my field. To mark my territory, I created a meditation circle in the middle of it. I tried to be there every morning to claim my place in the universe. But to tell the truth, I didn't always make it. I thanked the crows for waking me when they did. The circle in the place I christened Meadow Garden became my power spot. A path appeared from my feet, pacing rhythmically around it in meditation. In winter, the walking kept me from getting cold. In the summer, the movement kept away the mosquitoes. It also kept me from getting sleepy or getting stiff while sitting. Walking means you have to keep your eyes open. All the senses are engaged, as in any kind of meditation, to concentrate takes effort. Yet just simply walking in a circle is enough to get you high and attune you to the universe. Strangely, the roots of my walking meditation go back to my commuting days in Tokyo, when I lived in the suburbs. I wasn't a salaryman, but a day laborer, a gardener. I like to think this was a bit more fashionable and further up the labor ladder. No pun intended. My commute started at 6:30 a.m. For most of the first year, I managed to get up at 5 a.m., do a traditional sitting meditation in the house, and eat a proper breakfast before going off to work. However, the more Japanese I became, the longer and harder I worked, the later my wake-up times became. One morning I overslept, so I decided to squeeze in my meditation while walking to the station. The walk began with a packed black dirt footpath along the edge of the Tamagawa Josui Canal. I could see and hear water. Sunlight filtered through the high canopy of the Zelkova trees. At that hour, the air was clean and fresh. I should do this every day, I thought. Out of necessity, a natural progression to my nature meditation practices was born. I walked at a medium pace, somewhere between the leisurely dog walkers and the rushing commuters. The walk to the station, however, only took 10 minutes, just enough time to do the first part of my meditation, the breathing practices. Inside the crowded, clammy train, I had already learned that I should hold my breath as long as possible rather than continue deep breathing. I always stood by the door so I could breathe in fresh air at each stop, a survival rather than a meditation technique. I found I could, however, say my prayers silently on the train, and it was a fruitful way to pass the time on the Chuo line. One day, as I silently said one of my favorite lines from a daily prayer, quote, "Pour upon us thy love and thy light," unquote, I realized that I was saying it for all the people crushed around me on the train. Pour upon us thy love and thy light. It was an odd place for an awakening. Human beings were the only natural elements around. Standing surrounded by bodies, it wasn't actually a walking meditation, but there was movement, the rattling train speeding through time and space. I thought of Jalal ad-Din Rumi, the mystic poet who inspired the whirling dervishes of Konya, Turkey, becoming one with everything. Although I didn't physically whirl in the train, the insight changed my attitude toward the crowds. When I saw the man I named I nicknamed Smokestack, smoke puffing out of his ears seconds before he stepped on the train. I started to grin. The pale-looking hyper guy in the stained white shirt serving me at the platform coffee stand started to look handsome, his speedy movements a rhythmic performance. In the railway carriage, I tried to enjoy the odd Japanese feeling of skinship with perfect strangers, the smell of men's oily hair tonics filling my nostrils. The morning meditation walk combined with contemplation on the train somehow set the mood for the day. Living in Tokyo, I attempted to find nature and the sacred in everyday city life, as well as in the gardens where I worked. Sometimes it was heaven, and sometimes, yes, it was hell. More often, things just didn't make sense. On the commuting walk to Takanodai, there was a big old cherry tree at the edge of what was then a natural park. Every day on the way to work, I would walk under it. One day, they chopped it down. It was there in the morning and gone in the evening when I came home. They paved paradise and put up a parking lot, as Joni Mitchell sings. Every time I hear that song, I think of that tree. Every time I see misplaced development, I sing it. These days, my commute is approximately 5 meters, about 6 steps, and takes a mere 10 seconds. My studio workplace is just across the deck from our living quarters. It takes me longer to brew my first cup of strong black tea than to get to work. My favorite place for the morning meditation is about 30 seconds away, under the cherry tree I planted in the garden. I like to think we took paradise and we made it better. And emits just a little bit. Standing under the cherry tree, I do the breathing practices centered on the four elements, followed by my prayers. In winter, the winds from the north hit me in the face. In summer, the tree provides shade. I prefer to do my mantras walking. It took a while to get used to walking down the garden path we named Edogawa instead of walking in a circle. Like life, this path is not perfectly straight, but meanders like a stream. I walk it with a measured step, end to end, one step per syllable of mantra, making slow U-turns at the border of my property. To anyone who is watching, it probably looks ridiculous. Edo-san, getting a little senile, eh? Someone might say. Life is not easy. Things are seldom perfect. Heaven above, paradise on earth, a vision in our minds. I'll accept whatever I can get. And it finishes with a poem. Wind on face, sun in eyes, bird in ears, body standing, mind spacing, winter sunlight melting, warm sunlight melting heart, warm breeze relaxing thought, warm feeling spreading, I depart, morning meditation. So that, thank you. Something about photography, okay. Being a photographer and toting around a lot of heavy equipment is not as romantic as the resulting photos can sometimes appear. It's hard work. This spring season, I have once again been searching for the perfect but elusive cherry blossom tree. I spent a few days wandering the nearby hills and paddies, but alas, it was hard to come by. Often the scene was close to perfect, but always there was some unnecessary element, man-made or otherwise, which upset the balance, subtracted from the beauty. At one place, it was a sign painted on an ugly bare plywood telling me, this is a famous old tree. Another sign reminded me not to litter while up In a nearby tree, shards of a wind-battered black and white plastic rubbish flapped on the tree branches like strangled birds, haunting those of us trying to enjoy nature. In the Japanese countryside, many picturesque cherry trees are planted around folks' houses and often commemorate an event, like a child entering elementary school. Often it seems no thought has been given to the background. The everyday surroundings tend to overpower the beauty of the tree. Yet this, I suppose, is the view of a photographer and a poet. The average Mr. Tanaka or Miss Sato most likely never gives it a thought. They will visit their local temple or shrine or riverside park somewhere to appreciate the beauty of cherry blossoms. Then they return home to their cluttered yard, feeling inspired to decorate the tokonoma or entrance foyer with a flowering branch from their own cherry tree, sadly wedded to an electric pole behind their garage. Wherever they are planted, at least the cherry trees, like weed flowers, never give up trying to show us beauty.
Let's open it up to questions. So just raise your hand if anybody wants to ask a question. Okay, Barry, Barry, you're unmuted, yes.
Thanks, Leanne. Hello, Edward. Hello. We haven't met face to face. I really like your lifestyle over there. Your photography I find fascinating. I noticed that you go for the extremes from pinhole photography to drone photography. I mean, one is really naturalistic and simple, and the other is high-tech and GPS and that. Now, I'm doing a little droning myself at the moment. I'm having trouble getting permissions to fly near airports. What sort of problems do you find with moving into technological photography like droning and the technological problems that you have with deploying your drone where you are? Thank you.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting question, and it goes back to one theme, right place, right time. I've been shooting videos of our garden for about a couple of years now, hoping to make a little documentary video about our garden. And I was thinking, gee, it would be nice to have some drone shots. And one day out of the blue, someone sent me, someone I know in Kamigawa, an amateur photographer, said, I bought a drone. Do you know how to use a drone? Will you teach me how to use it? And I said, I don't know anything about drones. And would you teach me? And I've been thinking I need some pictures of drones of my garden. So to make a long story short, he gave me one lesson. Then he came over one day and we did some shots. One came out okay, but I was not satisfied. Because you're never satisfied if you're a photographer, you always want to go for a little more, a little more. And he left me the drone for 3 or 4 days a week. And I just went out and did it. And there's no license needed out here where I live. And I didn't fly very far because I was afraid to go very far. And I was afraid to crash this guy's drone. But I did get the shots that I liked. And moving video shots, so yes. But the question is, I don't think I want to buy one because I don't want to get any more involved with any more technical stuff. And this gentleman has offered to loan me his or come over and help me anytime I want to do some shots. So it's kind of like you got to stop somewhere. And I feel like the drone is kind of crossing the line. If I could do pinhole drone, maybe I might be interested in it, but I'm not quite sure it's possible or to rip up $800. The cheapest drone, $800 drone, to make it a pinhole is a little risky.
Thanks, Barry.
Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, thanks, Edward. Thanks.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Rebecca?
Yeah, just let me unmute myself. Ed, I'd like to know the relationship between the original old house and the house you live now. Do you still own that old house, or are they close by to each other, or what?
They're kind of close. Well, not close. I'm a 20-minute drive, so it's in the next door neighbor's valley. Originally, in fact, it was in one of the essays that I wrote, but I cut that line just to make it a little bit shorter. We rented it. It was an old farmhouse that we rented 25,000 yen per month for 16 years. And at that time we used it 24/7 as a studio, living place, doing workshops and hosting the Chernobyl children and doing many different things there. I would have happily bought it. And as I wrote in the book, I was happy to bury my bones there, as the Japanese like to say. Unfortunately, the owner said, well, someday I want to come back. He was about my age. So we happened to, you know, a friend happened to come by. We said, yeah, we're thinking of looking for some land, maybe go to Nagano or somewhere. And he said, I know a nice piece of land in Kamurawa. And he took us to see it. And it looked worse than that first empty nothing photo that I showed you. It looked worse than that. And then we just fell in love with it first sight. And, you know, on the way home, we called the guy up and we bought it like the next day for knocking off a quarter of the price from the what they asked. So, you know, I may not post all the photos that I take on my blog or Facebook or whatever, but I do send them out to people, email or whatnot, people that I know that I like. I write a poem. I'm not one of these people that sends every poem I know out on Facebook or every little new vignette. I write a new vignette that I get an inspiration and I write it down. It has nothing to do with photography. So I send it to friends who are not, you know, they don't know an iPhone from a compact camera kind of thing, you know, and I send them just the vignette and they have their own imagination. They don't need the photo to see it. So that's another way to look at it. But I try to send them Thanks. To people who I think need it. If that sounds presumptuous, I'm sorry, but. Any questions, any topic?
Any other questions?
Any topic is valid. Gabrielle, yes?
Gabriella?
Hi, Ed, good evening.
Good evening.
Nice to see you again. Just a question about your creation, Whisper of the Land. Could you tell us the story behind the creation of it and what the vision for it was and
Yes.
how it all came about?
Yes, I will. You know, I never thought of myself. I've got my notes because these are things that came to me very recently because of Leanne, you know, arranging this just inspired me to get these things out. But I never thought of myself as a memoirist, so to speak. But almost everything that I write is first person narrative, whether it's essays or vignettes, my poetry, even my haiku, even my magazine articles. I shouldn't use the word hate, but I hate to write articles where you have to do a lot of research and you know, do this kind of stuff. I like to do my first person account stories. I like it to be personal, but I like it to be universal at the same time. Maybe not every paragraph and every page is universal for every person, but if they're parts, bits and pieces that get help people, then I like that. And I must say that I consider, you know, I don't consider myself a memoirist. I guess I am, but I consider originally I called Whisper of the Land a collection of essays. And I've also been called down on that, so to speak, you know. This is like a hodgepodge of essays just picked up here and there that have been put together. I have had some negative feedback. So I will be honest about that. But you know, these are essays that I wrote from my own experiences. And I just wrote them as I felt them. There was no outline. There was no so-called real structure for the first book. And to go back just a second to the book I showed you, Iwanami Shoten, that was the editor who did that book. After he said, wow, you're really a good essay writer. Why don't you have any more? So I showed him three or four other essays that I'd written before I forgot them about my early days in Japan. And he said, hey, these are good. Let's do a book. And so we did. And he helped me get it organized, but he was also not into doing it chronologically. And it was almost like I'd write a chapter and I'd give it to my wife who did the first translation. She'd send it to the publisher and I'd be working on the next translation. So it's very different from the other memoirists here I know for sure, like Leanne and Karen, who have done a lot of work, packaging and structuring and organizing their works. So admittedly, in the book, a few themes get mentioned more than one time. This is another thing that I've been called down upon. They're usually the ones that are dealing with doing your daily practice, following the rituals, seeking perfection. And they're right. But all of these are never-ending pursuits. In fact, I call my whole life here, I call it the never-ending story, because not just my spiritual life, but my physical life. There's, if you live in the country and you have your own house and your own water system and your composting toilet, there's always something to do. So it's a never-ending story. And so these are themes that I think need to be repeated. And if I went back and rewrote it again, I would maybe do it differently. But each chapter, I mean, when I made it as a book, I went back with the editor and I did have to do some things to connect the essays together till we make it a book. But I could also rewrite each essay so that it stood on its own without being in a book. And I would be just as happy if they were published somewhere like that.
Thank you.
That helps.
I have a question.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think you say in the beginning that the Japanese translation came out first.
Is yes, that correct? It did.
Or the simultaneous? It wasn't simultaneous first.
Well, the Japanese book came out first, but it's a slightly different book. The Japanese book was written for the Japanese audience, and so there was a lot of stuff that I had wrote in the English book that was not needed in the Japanese book. So when I decided to do it, we published it in Japanese. And unfortunately it came out on March, right at the end, right after the Tohoku tsunami disaster. So it got like zero publicity, just kind of went down the drain, and it was a hardback book, overpriced. But the basic story is exactly the same because I'm the same person. I did add one new chapter in the English version. I added a chapter about my impressions of the Tohoku disaster. And I wrote this English version I wrote for non-Japanese speakers. So there was a whole lot of rewriting that was done and on that. So, but if it hadn't been for the Japanese editor kind of pushing me and getting it, doing it, I probably wouldn't have done it.
I see.
Thanks.
More questions?
Anyone else? Any more? I've got a question, Ed.
Okay.
Hello, you.
As I was reading Whisper the Land, all this 60s music came into my head. And I'm thinking, wow, so that's what happened to the hippies. They left America and they went to Japan. You know, you just wonder whatever happened to the ideals of the 60s, to the back to the earth movement, to the vegetarianism, to love and peace, and all these ideals that disappeared by the mid 70s. Were you aware of that when you were coming to Japan, that you were taking that in your knapsack too, so to speak, that was in your baggage, the ideals?
Yes, I was kind of on the cusp of the hippie era, as they say. I graduated from high school in 1972, so I first time I got stoned was also in 1972, so I was not exactly what you would call the hardcore hippie, but I was a vagabond and I did come to Japan with my rucksack. But before I went to Japan, I was living in the woods on a back to the land community with like-minded spiritual people where all the practices that I mentioned in the very beginning are practices that I learned 40 years ago or more, 45 years ago, and I'm still doing them. And something that's very dear to me. And it's kind of funny that when I was in high school, the high school yearbook, you know, they write what this person is going to be in the future. And it said, Edward Levinson, pseudo hippie. I never quite understood what that meant, but I think I'm one of the few people of all my friends of that era who are still staying true to their ideals. I like to think I am. And so that's Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Can you talk about the price that you had to pay to stay true to those ideals?
Well, right now, you know, like I say, I don't want to go out and buy another drone. That's one thing, but that's a technological thing. But, you know, we're kind of on the border here of the technology and the living on the earth. I have a well that's a hand-dug well, and just recently it stopped producing water. As you, most of you who are in Japan now know, that it's been pouring for days and days. And I went down and checked my well yesterday, and it's like not empty. So there's a big problem. So this is part of the never-ending story that I like to joke about. I was going to read the story about how I met my better half. She's got my wife who collaborated with all the books. It was a little bit long, so I decided not to, but she gets a kick out of this. I will say that when we met and we started, first met her, and we decided to be together, she said, "May I help you?" And I said, "Yes, you may." And we were at a bookstore, and neither of us knew at that time that 40 plus years later, we would still be together. And God bless her. She is the stick that God beats me with to keep me true to my ideals. So those of you who might not be in the perfect relationship, there are reasons to stick with it. It's in the Japanese book, you know, that my wife is kind of like, you know, the Zen master walking around. And when you sort of start to fall asleep, he bops you on the shoulder and gets you back on the track. And I owe her a lot of gratitude because, you know, if it wasn't for her, I probably wouldn't still be in Japan. I wouldn't be a photographer. I might still be living in the countryside, but it would probably be like more like a shack or, you know, a hermit, something a lot more simple. I still, to go back to living to the, there are times when I really do want to give it all up and go back to the life of when you have a lot of, when you're, it's less complicated, there's less stuff. I don't foresee it happening in the near future. When I turned, this is just a little bit longer, but when I turned 60 of some years ago, I thought, well, I'll take a sabbatical from my life and I'll travel to Africa with a backpack and a little tiny camera. And I'll just, you know, stay 6 months. And I didn't do it. A couple of more years until I'll be 70. So maybe when I'm 70, I'll think about trying it again. When you don't have children like we do, and you have a lot of things, even though you're living a simple life, we have a big place and there's a lot of things. And if you're a photographer, there's a lot of equipment and photographs that just keep piling up and piling up, and books that you publish that don't sell. And, you know, kind of wonder, well, what will become of all this when we're gone?
Ed, I'd like to also ask one more thing on this, because it's such a, to me, such a kind of core issue. It goes to the heart of the book, and that is your relationship with the villagers, with the Japanese people who live in your community. And it's something really that was inspiring, how you managed to strike a balance. And I wonder if that was easier when you were living so to speak, eye to eye, but being on Solo Hill, kind of above the community in the big house on the hill, the foreigner on the big house on the hill, did that change the relationship?
It did a little bit. I'm sure, as Karen and Rebecca probably as well knows, that when we lived in the old farmhouse, yes, we were slightly more involved in the community. And we, you know, went to the shrine, we carried the omikoshi, and we did these things that we did. And we also got the community involved with the, when we did some homestay projects with the Chernobyl, these children from Chernobyl who came to Japan. I had some of these in the slideshow, but we didn't get that far. But the, these groups of children who came to, from the contaminated area of Chernobyl, came and stayed in Japan at our farmhouse for like a month on a so-called get healthy homestay. There was another story that I didn't read about an old grandmother that I met. And maybe we'll use this. I have the closing reading that I wanted to do. It's very short. Okay. This is the introduction to it, because the whole chapter is too long to read. But I was out taking some photographs one day looking for a nice cherry tree, which I didn't find, but I saw this old grandmother up in this kind of field that looked like it hadn't been taken care of in a while. And she was digging this huge garden, like about a third of the size of my house. And she was digging it with a spade. She was like in her 80s, she was bent over in her Mompei pants. And I saw her, I didn't even see her. I could hear her, she had a radio playing. She was listening to the radio while she worked. And I went over and I chatted her up and we talked. And I'd just been digging in my own garden recently. And I was just late watching this lady dig. She didn't have to do it. She didn't need the money. She was just doing it because it was in her genetic genes that she wanted. It was the thing to do. Her husband had passed away. Maybe she had a memory of her husband and decided to go out and dig up her vegetable patch. Anyway, at the same time, I had been digging up my own potato patch, which is hard work. And I wrote, which inspired me to write an essay called, which is probably one of my favorite essays in the book. So if you haven't read it or if you get it, it's called Soil and Soul. And so I'll read this, and I think this will be the closing unless someone else has a question when we're finished. Is that okay, Leanne?
Sure, it sounds great.
And I do thank Leanne for inviting me and having me here as part of this series, and everyone for showing up.
Thanks, it's great.
Okay, so this is a very short excerpt, one of my favorites, and it ties into my little essay about a gardener and essay about being a meditator, if there is such a thing. And you know that I did come to Japan, one of the reasons was because I read a book by Masanobu Fukuoka called One Straw Revolution, which is about natural farming, which means it's farming where you don't dig and you don't have to work so hard. So this is a little inspiration. Working with the soil, soil and soul. Working with the soul and working with the soil are not all that different. Both are hard work. I dig down a spade length and flip the soil over, pulling out the tough weeds and breaking up the hard clay clumps. Is it a battle with the soil or a collaboration with nature? Is meditation a battle with the soul or a collaboration with a greater power? I wonder. Sometimes it's hard to tell. Does nature enjoy being used by humans, or would it rather be left alone to take its own course? Letting the strongest weeds and flowers be left alone to take its own course, letting the strongest leaves, flowers, and vegetables and insects live peacefully without the violence of the shovel or the plow. Perhaps this was the inspiration behind Fukuoka-san's philosophy of natural farming. Don't battle nature, imitate it. Don't battle the soul, imitate the divine.
Beautiful. Thank you.
First, I want to make a comment to thank Leanne for starting this series. I've read Edward and Karen and Rebecca's memoir so far about their time in Japan, and they really are very quite different in style and content, but very enriching, and they sort of have opened my eyes to the experience of living a long time in Japan, which hasn't been my opportunity, but I really appreciate people writing about that and sharing it with others.
Edward, I love your positivity. I mean, with it, your life is enviable, and I think a big part of what we envy is the positive spin that you put on your life. And I think we all make this choice as memoir writers to make it a celebration in order to learn from our experiences. The more we can celebrate, the more we can work through the layers of difficulty that got us to where we are and appreciate it. And so I really honor you for that. And I think your years of meditation and living close to the earth, and the work that you've done with the children of Chernobyl and other volunteer projects has been an inspiration to our generation. And I really hope that in the future, the future generations who are coming to Japan and make their lives here and know that it's all about the giving back. It's, you know, we're here to learn and be inspired, but also here to return something to elevate Japanese culture and society. So you've done an amazing job, and really my hat off to you.
Well, apologies if I talk too much about the meditation, but instead of, you know, my gabbing with the neighbors, but it's the meditation that is the root of the tree. Or the branches or the whole thing. I mean, there's a picture that I did. Oh, it's the picture that's on the Goshen website of a big tree with the roots as a big picture. And that the title of that piece is Reflections of Self. And it's a big, huge tree with huge roots going down to the earth and huge branches going off into the cosmos or wherever you want to call it. So that's how it is. And I appreciate everybody listening. And please check out the book if you hadn't. Please check out my website. Of course, check out Leanne's book and Karen's book and Rebecca's book and Warren's book and Everett's book to come. And I'm not sure who else has a book. Madeline has a book, so it's in Japanese. But everybody, please check out these available good books.
Thank you. That's great. And next month, August 1st, Rebecca Ottawa will be our next speaker. Rebecca, just wave your hand. And Rebecca's been a longtime inspiration to me. And so I'm thrilled that she'll be our next speaker and presenter on this theme of coming home far from home. Well, let's give Ed a round of applause.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for everyone.
I believe that everyone has a memoir within waiting to be born. And we can look back on our lives with gratitude and pride for growing beyond the limitations that society and our family background may have put before us, to discover the blessings of a life outside the comfort zone, to share stories that can inspire the friends and family who may not have understood us till now, and the many who have walked in our ways and are much in need of a role model. To call yourself a memoir writer begins the day you commit to telling your story. That's why I started GoshenBooks.com, to provide you with the tools and the incentive to complete your memoir. Get private coaching directly from me. One session can give you the focus you need, and regular weekly sessions will keep you on track to keep you motivated, accountable, and confident that your story matters, your life matters. You've got what it takes. Now go for it. Finish your book. Read the testimonials, the reviews, and sign up at GoshenBooks.com.